Yes, it's the peppy flute and the happy guitar there, letting you know that it's time once again for the Daily Connection here on KDUB. It's about 4.5 minutes after 10 o'clock on a Thursday, not just any old Thursday, but a Thursday when we have Matt and Chris in the studio once again. Matt McAuliffe and Chris White, both on staff at Trail Christian Fellowship, and they're my pals and just absolutely erudite and witty church history guys. I mean, you can talk to these guys just about anything.
No, really, Pat, I just can't take any more. Now, what was that again?
Yes,
I could just hear you talk all day about my erudition.
Yes, and, you know, that's it for the rest of the month. So.
Okay, well.
All right, but anyway, we have another fascinating topic today.
We have a good one.
Near and dear to my heart, and interesting, not an individual this time, but an event.
An event, yeah, something that we don't do awfully a lot. Mm-hmm. I think back in my recollection, we've only done maybe two other shows on events, but what we're talking about today is what we call, of course, the Scopes Monkey Trial, which happened in the summer of 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee, and truly one of the watershed events in our nation's history, and something that generally we all study in high school history, and most of us have formed an awareness of it through that, and of course the obligatory watching of the movie Inherit the Wind, which was sometimes a high school activity as well, if not on television. And
Spencer Tracy,
and who's the other guy that does Spencer Tracy?
Frederick March.
Frederick March, that's right.
Oh, a bunch of people.
Dick York is in that one?
He is.
As
John
in,
Scopes.
As in the real Darren?
Yes.
Wow, that's awesome.
Before Bewitched.
There you go. I didn't know that one. But anyway, we're going to be talking about what really happened at that trial and partly its effects on our country and its effects on the church.
Amen. An important event. Just to bring everybody up to speed, Pat, we've all heard of Darwin and everything. You know, just before the American Civil War, Charles Darwin, I won't say a mediocre scientist, but he came up with what was called, he published in 59, The Origin of Species, which forwarded the basic evolution doctrine. Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't the first time anybody talked about it. Aristotle, you know, first hit on it back in the 4th century B.C., but Darwin published this thing, and it was scientifically discredited badly. He didn't do a good job of it. His evidence was poor and remains so to this day. And primarily, the scientific community just kind of snubbed him. However, as a matter of fact, by 71, when he published The Descent of Man, Darwin practically repudiated his own evolution theories, except in terms of being applied to society and human development. So anyway, if the scientific community got rid of him, the social community, the rising humanists, they love this stuff. And what developed was a movement called social Darwinism. Mm. And all the the glittering Illuminati of the day, George Bernard Shaw, Andrew Carnegie, H.G. Wells, Bertrand Russell, John Maynard Keynes, T.H. Huxley, all these guys just embraced this, you know, that it was the beautiful people theory. You know,
as that does not affect you and I. What is that about?
Well, you know, they just basically said that there were people who were more physically and mentally advanced, and it was their duty to sort of generally discourage the development of undesirable individuals.
Oh, eugenics.
Well, by golly, it went right into eugenics. That was the Nazi Party platform after it had been tinkered with by a German social scientist. I think Ernst Haeckel was his name. But primarily, this really became a way of weeding people out. I mean, it was a theory for weeding people out. It was a justification for any movement or people or government to get rid of undesirables. Now, Hitler put this to the fullest use on an industrial scale, but even in the United States, in the 1920s, we experimented by compulsory sterilization. We infected poor people with syphilis. The government did. It's just appalling. It was the arrogance of this, and people just need to realize that that really is what Darwinism is about. I mean, it's not just the science is cracked up to be, but that basically is the element and atmosphere, optimism of people that, yes, we can control the development of the human race.
Progress is natural.
Yeah, and this is the atmosphere in 1925.
And then this, of course, comes to a head, really, in our country, socially, at the Scopes Monkey Trial, just an 11-day period in July of 1925. What it was, you know, if we want to talk about the facts amid the fiction, and I think it's worthy of talking about that today because of the fact that most people's only knowledge is a page or two in their history textbook or the movie, both of which are deeply, deeply edited from reality.
We'll get to that.
But we'll talk about, at least today, about the facts amid the fiction. It was a trial, the Scopes Monkey Trial was a trial to test the legality of any law which prohibits the teaching of evolution in public schools. It was actually written by a Mr. Butler in Tennessee. He was a farm owner and got elected to the state legislature and was concerned that he was trying to teach his boys at home to be men of God and live a godly life, and yet public money was being used to sponsor schools, and public money was also being used to present theories and ideas that were contrary to what the kids were being taught at home, and he felt that this needed to be prohibited, at least on the in schools funded by public money. Well, this law was enacted. It was passed by a huge margin in the both houses of the Tennessee legislature, and that was immediately wanting to be put to the test by the ACLU. And
didn't they actually run an ad in the newspaper?
Well, that's the thing that I think a lot of people need to understand that does not come out, of course, in the play or anything, is that this was basically a manufactured media event. There was no angry parents or a witch hunt to find John Scopes, this man of integrity, intellectual integrity, who was just mining in his own business, being drugged like Christ was before the Sanhedrin.
He wasn't even a biology teacher, was he?
He was nothing. You know, the ACLU put an ad in the paper, in several papers throughout Tennessee, asking and offering to pay the legal expenses of anyone who wanted to challenge this. And the funny thing is who took them up on this was not really John Scopes, but was the town fathers of Dayton, Tennessee. They said, you know, if we had a trial like this, it would really put us on the map. and it would give us some publicity and might help stimulate the economy in our town. And they actually kind of hatched a plan. And they found John Scopes, who is a person specifically recruited to stand as the defendant in the trial. And he actually was never a biology teacher. He was a
substituted one.
He was a substitute for a biology class one time. He was actually a physics teacher, but his main qualification was that he was willing to publicly state that he felt that there was no way you could teach biology without bringing up evolution. And so that's what he did. He never actually taught evolution in the Dayton schools as well. He was using a biology textbook that contained a chapter on Darwin's theory of evolution, but he admitted to reporters after the trial was over that he actually had never assigned any reading in that chapter. He'd actually passed over it and was doing something else at the time. But, it was all kind of done pretty much by innuendo. And he admitted to reporters.
He was scared they were going to find it out.
Yeah, after the trial was over, and then later in his autobiography that came out to do that. And then, of course, the attorneys that prosecuted John Scopes, the people that initially got this case going were actually two of his personal friends. And then, of course, this, as it became the big media event, attracted two of the most well-known personalities in America at the time, two lawyers. Everybody knew was a household name, and that was William Jennings Bryan, who was an absolute celebrity. He had ran for president unsuccessfully three times, but had quite a well-known candidacy and was a man of the people, and was...
A reformer,
but also prior to that time held the position of Secretary of State under President Woodrow Wilson, and was also a man who was instrumental in the passage of the constitutional amendments for prohibition and for unfortunately, income tax. The federal government can get income tax out of individuals. And then finally also was instrumental in helping women get the vote. So he was quite a character. But he was also a very devout Christian. Amen. And although he lacked any formal theological education, partly what brought him to this cause was he saw the end game of the whole thing of Darwinianism and felt this challenge to the Christian worldview was very dangerous for America. His opponent, of course, in the trial, we all know Clarence Darrow, was America's most well-known defense lawyer and was kind of a Johnny Cochran type, you know, who'd take the real hard cases. He was into anything that smacked of suppression or censorship in this country. Those were kind of some of his favorite civic causes, although he was more of a criminal lawyer. And ironically, he was good friends with William Jennings Bryan and actually had supported him in his presidential campaigns. Really about the only thing that they differed on was the area of religion, where Clarence Darrow was a agnostic and a very, very strong agnostic.
Pretty interesting guy, Darrow, too. A very mercenary, very cynical. Gosh, I think he had just come off successfully defending two child murderers and got them off the hook. So, I mean, this is not a guy too overly bothered by relative morality. He pretty much does whatever he thinks he wants to do. There's one other interesting personality here, and that was the reporter for the Baltimore Sun who did most of the coverage that was used in the development of the later play, Inherit the Wind. That's H.L. Mencken.
Oh, yeah,
you remember him.
I'm a Maryland boy.
Gracious. Well, I won't belabor the point much except to say that H.L. Mencken is the most rabid, anti-Christian, cynical, nasty, bitter journalist, although he was very characteristic of the times. Just hated everybody and everything.
Except himself, of course.
Well, this is what he had to say. He said, Americans generally were the most timorous, sniveling, poltroonish, ignominious mob of serfs and goose-steppers ever gathered under one flag in Christendom since the end of the Middle Ages. This is not an easy-to-talk-to, user-friendly kind of guy.
But you think you can pick up his opinion.
Yeah. What are you trying to say, H.L.?
He was also kind of far from a biased reporter in the fact that his newspaper actually was picking up the living expenses of the defense lawyers for John Scope. So he definitely had a real agenda. And then, of course, he also, which is kind of quite laughable, is he also portrayed the people of Dayton, Tennessee as this angry, ignorant mob of yokels, when in fact the people in Dayton, Tennessee were actually quite friendly, quite excited about the hubbub, actually decorated the town up like there was a big carnival and festival going on, held welcome banquets for both William Jennings Bryan and for Clarence Darrow when they came to town. The people were actually kind of excited just to be in the news and be the big thing. They were hardly angry at all. It was more of a carnival scene than a mob scene.
But we just need to remember, too, that for H.L. Mencken and all the reporters there, their job was to build this into a global event.
Absolutely.
And it was actually the first trial ever to be broadcast on radio.
I was going
to
say.
It was, there were reporters from Hong Kong, from London. I mean, this just went bizarre. And the reporters felt no compunction to report accurately. This was the age of yellow journalism when William Randolph Hearst ran the papers. And if he said that Cuba attacked us and we should go to war with Spain, then by golly, you know, that's what his papers printed and we did it.
We don't need to mind the facts.
No connection whatsoever with reality. One reporter was even didn't attend the trial sessions, and when asked about it, he said, "I don't have to know what's going on. I know what my paper wants me to write." I mean, that was the general attitude of the reporting going on in that day.
What was really funny about the whole Scopes trial is that legally, actually, nothing happened for 11 days, and the defense for John Scope actually asked for a guilty verdict from the jury so that they could just have the right to appeal this to the Tennessee Supreme Court. And so the trial never actually did anything, and when it finally went to the higher court for review, they ended up basically throwing everything out because of the fact John Scopes had been offered a job elsewhere and was no longer working for the state of Tennessee. And so they, you know, it basically had the legal effect of doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the whole thing about constitutional law prohibiting any law that prohibits the teaching of evolution did not come about for another 43 years. So this particular trial did nothing legally, but it did do something else. And that was, it had a public humiliation of William Jennings Bryan. Mm-hmm. It was a really kind of almost an emotional defeat for a lot of those who held to a conservative belief in the Bible. And what happened was, in the trial, Clarence Darrow was able to get William Jennings Bryan on the stand to testify about his beliefs in the Bible. And the questions were very, very narrowly directed. And Bryan was, of course, not a theologian, and in the end was made to pretty much kind of look like a buffoon. And in fact, Clarence Darrow was supposed to reciprocate and get on the stand where Brian could interrogate him about his agnosticism, but he used a legal maneuver in the end to get out of that. And then 5 days after the trial, William Jennings Bryan died. A lot of people said he died of stress and exhaustion from being humiliated, but in fact was eager and anxious and getting ready to prepare for the next trial, was out making speeches, and many people believe he died of complications of diabetes is actually what happened.
Well, you know, the bottom line, Pat, was ultimately the fundamental Christian community came away from this trial, especially with its grotesquely bad reporting, with a public bloody nose. And it kind of heightened the sense that Christians felt of the division between Christianity and science. It was as if you had to choose one or the other. Mm-hmm. You couldn't believe science and still be a good Christian, or you couldn't be a good Christian and still be scientific. And that was weird. I mean, that was a falsehood, a distortion, but it was really played up. Well, things might have died down, except in the 1950s. With McCarthyism coming up and just the insane hunt for communism in government ranks, a couple guys wrote a play called Inherit the Wind in 1950 and just farmed this out to Broadway. It was based primarily on Mencken's reporting of the Scopes trial. Well, that didn't even really catch on that much until in 1960 it was made into a movie. The movie with Spencer Tracy and everything. And this movie, I don't know, if you've ever seen the Nazi or the Soviet Stalinist propaganda films, that's pretty much what we're talking here. I just watched it again for the first time in 20 years, and I just was fuming by the time I was done. I even remembered it as a good movie in the old days. But Spencer Tracy, Frederick March, Dick York, Henry Morgan, all these guys, and primarily it makes no attempt to be good history. It just plays the party line. If you're a scientific person, then you're a rational, quiet speaking, friendly, kind portrayal, the actor that plays you. If you're a Christian, then you're a stupid, bigoted, full screaming. I mean, that's who you are in the movie. I mean, they've got the townspeople ready to lynch Scopes. They've got riots. It just turns your stomach. I mean, you could be a Christian, and by the time you're done, you're those dirty Christians. Golly, how can they hurt those wonderful scientific people? It's a bad movie. I mean, it's good drama, but it's horrible propaganda. I mean, and then it was remade again in 1988 here in our own beloved Jacksonville with George C. Scott and Jason Robards and Gene Simmons. These are interesting films to peruse, but boy, oh boy, for a Christian to go in there, realize you're not watching history. You're watching
propaganda.
Agenda-fed propaganda from the humanist movement, boy, and it's bad. It's really bad.
You know, one of the things I think that we ought to think about this whole scenario is the fact that church historians have long suggested that this trial caused many Bible-believing Christians to disengage from society because of the public humiliation that happened in that. And, feeling that their faith was discredited, they did that disconnect, as Matthew suggested. But the interesting thing is as time has passed, the fact is that evolution has been more and more discredited, and yet Christianity remains a very, very tenable position intellectually and spiritually, of course. And I think that's a lesson to us all, because I have a sneaking suspicion that we're going to see in our lifetime and in our future our beliefs once again rocked, especially with as much playing, biology and eugenics and all these things are becoming more and more of a playground for science and industry, and we may have some other thing come up that is going to where we're going to be looking at the soul and the very nature of who a human being is, and I think we can learn a lesson from that, is that we need to hold the course and hold our faith, because in the end it seems that all other philosophies fall to the wayside, and yet Christianity remains. And we need to hold our heads up high and not be sucked into the manufactured media event of the moment.
Well, you know, there is the tendency for Christians to go into a discussion on science a little afraid, a little embarrassed, a little intimidated. Yeah, that's crazy. There's no reason to do that. I mean, all the reputable scientists are backpedaling from evolution right about now quickly as they can.
I give it 15, 20 years. This is Atlantis, that evolution will be laughable.
Well, it just never had any evidence. You remember the peppered moth thing that we all saw in our high school textbooks? That never happened.
Through science class, so I never did see
Well, the peppered moth thing, in the soot and all that was actually a manufactured demonstration in England.
They glued them to the tree.
I mean, hello, and this is being portrayed in our schools as reality. So I don't know. It's just we Christians need to realize that that God is not in trouble. You know, whatever he created is okay. We don't have to be afraid of science. As a matter of fact, real science and real scientists are engaged in truth, which is what actually exists, the way things are created. As a matter of fact, what you hear these days, the scientific community, I'm not talking about the Christian scientists, but the scientific community in general, are addressing this now, and they're not calling it creationism. That would be too blatant to surrender. They're calling it intelligent design. They're looking at the universe and saying, there's just no way that this came into being.
So you're telling me that, like, scientists are thinking that there might be, like, some sort of divine creator behind things?
Oh, and they're struggling with this. You know, Stephen Hawking, the crippled British physicist who is arguably the most brilliant mind in the human race right now, he even says, you know, golly, this is what all the evidence points to, and yet I can't make this leap in my mind. And I think that's the problem right now. It calls for, in order to rationally assess the empirical knowledge and evidence available, it leads you to believe in a creator. And boy, the scientific community is having a hard time with it. But that's the upshot. The changes that have occurred in the sciences of geology and physics right now.
Biology.
Oh, my heavens.
Darwin thought the human egg was about as complicated as a spoonful of Jell-O. And in 1860, you know, things have gone a little beyond that, and there's no way you can justify the incredible complexity that you see under the microscope or through the telescope and just say, well, no, yeah, this happened by accident. The chances of it happening by accident exceed the number of known atoms in the universe if you work it out mathematically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you said right at the beginning there that the scientists discredited pretty much Darwinism, the philosophers are the ones who loved it.
Oh, amen.
And to this day, if you want to have an argument, you're going to have to go to the philosophy department to get somebody to oppose the idea of a design or creator.
Well, it's a great justification for pointing to a group of people different than your own and saying, well, you know, they're inferior to us, of more of a right to the good things in life. Mm-hmm. And you'll always find a ready audience for that, I'm afraid, among fallen humanity. So it's very interesting. As a matter of fact, we would encourage, there's so many great resources, Pat.
Baltimore Sun. No. Okay, well, short of maybe getting a subscription.
I need a button that ejects Christopher from the studio here. One of the things we really would love for people to go to the bookstore and get, any Christian, it's called The Six Modern Myths. And it's the textbook that the three of us have been using there at Pacific Bible College to teach Christian history. It just explodes some of the myths that we've grown up with. You know, the anti-ecological concept that Christians have, that the idea that missionaries mistreated natives. Not to mention Darwinism. I mean,
Galileo was in there.
I mean, he goes back, and this is by Philip Sampson. He goes back and just explodes all these myths. Another one, any of the half dozen books by Philip Johnson. Mm-hmm.
Philip Johnson is fabulous. He is a law professor at University of Berkeley, of all places, and a devout Christian. You talk about having a Christian in the bastion of the virtual citadel of secular humanism.
Amen.
There he is, right there at the gates of it in Berkeley, California. But his writings and his analysis of evolution is fabulous, fabulous.
Oh, and one last local resource that we have to talk about, a guy who's really terrific, Tom Kendall, who is actually able to come out and lecture at churches, and he's written a bunch of stuff. You can call here at KDove or out at Trail Fellowship, and we've got his name and address and everything. But there is just an endless supply of really terrific empirical knowledge gauged for a regular Christian to read it, not a scientist, but a regular person, and be able to adequately defend his faith, stand toe-to-toe with anybody that's got any kind of modern scientific credentials.
And I'm happy to say that we've had Philip Johnson on this program.
No kidding. At this very same microphone.
Not in the studio, but on the phone. And, of course, we've had Tom Kendall a lot. We've had William Dembski on here. So you just keep listening to the Daily Connection, where we have guys like Matt and Chris.
Man,
once
I'll tell you,
month, baby.
It's neat to be associated with that crowd.
All right. Well, we're already out of time here, fellas, but thanks for doing the Scopes trial today.
Amen.
And we'll do another one again next week. I'm Pat Daly. This is the Daily Connection here on KDOV.